Okay, so now we can finish off the gradual path, the gradual training, and do the very last bits that fit in here. And we have, so this is now going back to the page, what is it, page number 5 or something like that? Page 5, I think it is. This is where we'll be talking about, at the very beginning of this retreat, we're looking at the sense restraint and the mindfulness and clear comprehension. And we were just about to start the 5 hindrances, and then we stopped and we took this detour, which was the rest of the retreat, and now we can come back to the beginning, to where we started out pretty much again. And this is where the rest of this gradual path is. What is interesting is that the rest of the path now is about the final abandoning of the 5 hindrances, the practice of the jhanas, and then the awakening stages that come, actually arise from that. And this here is really the result of the path. So what we're looking at now is the result. That's why we're going to do it fairly quickly. We do it quickly because the work is really in everything else that we do. That's where the hard work is. And then these things just kind of happen as a result of all the hard work you put into the rest of the training here. So that is one reason why we're going to not put so much emphasis on this. And of course, the other is that these are the very high states of mind. So they're very kind of inspiring, but for most people, they are something that you aspire towards rather than something that you experience here and now. Some people experience them here and now, but for the most people, it is something that you kind of, okay, down the road somewhere, these things will happen. But the hard work is all the things that we have looked at, and this is now the results, all that hard work. And it's nice, of course, to know a bit about the results. So we're going to see what this is. But first of all, we're going to have a look at the 5 hindrances. And this is, in many ways, of course, a little bit part of the work, although the abandoning of hindrances, if you do everything we have talked about so far, even that is fairly straightforward, actually, here. So what comes here, then, is we have looked at the sense, at the full awareness, and this is what happens next. Possessing this sum, the aggregate, the sum total of noble virtue, this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, or if you like, just full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. So all of these things, these are the places where kind of real meditation happens. It doesn't mention anything about Jhana Grove Retreat Center there, but you get the rough idea. These are secluded places, a secluded resort and resting place. And this is interesting, the very fact that meditation, when it goes deep and when it comes to the final stages, moving towards samadhi and all these kind of things, it happens in solitude. That's what it's saying here. So Jhana Grove, when you come on a retreat, is like a halfway house. You get out of your ordinary kind of comforts and you get to test yourself a little bit out, but it's kind of a nice halfway house before you go into full seclusion, just staying in your own cutie. But real meditation happens in seclusion. That is how you know that what happens next is also part of meditation practice. So what comes then is the standard passage on the abandoning of the 5 hindrances. And it is interesting, right, that the abandoning of the 5 hindrances comes at this particular point. Because it may seem as if we've been talking about the abandoning of defilements and hindrances all along. So how come it comes again? What is going on here? What is the meaning of this? Is it some kind of special meaning because we've been talking about this already? What is actually the story? What's the story here, as they say? And what it means is that when we talk about the abandoning of the hindrances in the suttas, it means the final refined defilements of the mind that are the problem that you have to get out of just before you enter samadhi. That is what it means. So the five hindrances does not mean all the coarse hindrances that we have to deal with early on, when we have to deal with, getting the body and speech right, or even the coarse kind of desires and anger and this kind of thing. It's part of the hindrances, but really the hindrances are just the refined things and the refined problems at the very end of the path before we enter samadhi. That's what it means. And they're often called the upakilesa in the Pali Suttas. And upakilesa means like the refined corruptions of the mind, the last kind of blockages that we're dealing with. So this is what we are, and this is what is coming up now. This is these five hindrances. Interesting, because what this passage now tells us, it tells us, well, you just abandon the five hindrances. I'll read it out in a second. But the question, of course, arises, well, yes, we should abandon them, but it doesn't really say anything about how we abandon these hindrances. It just says that we abandon them, and once they are abandoned, then the mind is ready for samadhi, and we enter the first jhana, and all of these kind of things. But so how does it actually happen? You can't just say, bring out the magic wand and kind of, that would be handy, but it doesn't work like that, and they're all gone. And the answer is that this happens through meditation practice, and specifically, it happens through the satipatthanas, right? That is where and how the abandoning of the five hindrances happen. And satipatthana practice is the practice that happens when mindfulness has already been established through sense restraint, through the right effort, all of these factors on the path. That is where satipatthana is possible. And if you read the Satipatthana Sutta, and you read satipatthana, how it is described in the Satipatthana Sanghita, which is the largest collections of suttas on satipatthana practice, found in the Sanghita Nikaya, Sanghita number 47. There's a large number of very nice suttas about satipatthana practice there. And if you look at that, how that works, it is all about overcoming the hindrances. Starts off with the body contemplation, right? It's to let go of some of the attachment and desires for the body. When you do that, the senses also, you lose some of the attachment to the senses at the same time. Then it is the Vedananupassana, the contemplation of feelings, and the contemplation of mind, the Chittanupassana. And if you look at that carefully, you will see it's all about understanding what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, then to enable you to move towards the wholesome. Again, about abandoning the hindrances. And then the very last one, which is perhaps the most interesting one, is the Dhammanupassana, the contemplation of causality or principles, how all of these things hang together. And when you read that, it specifically says that you understand each of the five hindrances, you understand its cause, you understand how it is abandoned, and how in the future it comes not to arise again in the future as well. So it's also about causality, and this is a large part of this abandoning of the hindrances, is to review your meditation, to understand what is going on, to understand the causes that lead to peace in your mind, the causes that lead to more disturbance. And so this reviewing of one's meditation is actually very useful, and it is perfectly in accord with the Satipatthana Sutta, how we come to understand causality, how it operates on the mental level. So this is how we do this, yeah? And even more specifically than that, because still it is not perhaps very clear how we contemplate feelings and all of these things. So even more specifically, how this is done is through things like anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath. The mindfulness of the breath is interesting because it is specifically said that this is the one meditation practice that fulfills the satipatthanas. That's all you have to do, is to watch the breath. That is the entire job, from the beginning all the way to the end. As soon as mindfulness is established sufficiently, mindfulness of breathing takes you all the way to the end of the path. That's all you have to do. Yeah, and the contemplation of feeling, of the mind and all that, it takes place within that framework of mindfulness of breathing here. So that's how it's done. That's how you abandon the hindrances. You just watch the breath. Yeah, and then you do a little bit of contemplation, a little bit of reflection after the meditation to see how it works. That's all you have to do. So it's very simple. It's very straightforward. It's a very instruction that is very easy to understand. And it doesn't need a lot of complicated mental work and a lot of contemplated complicated contemplation, all these kind of things. All you have to do is watch the breath. All you have to do is establish the virtue and then watch the breath. And then things kind of happen. And suddenly, one day, you are there. Yeah, this we're going to have a look at today. What happens when all of this goes right? And one day, bang, and you are, you know, you've got all the results that the path it promises you really have. So this is what this passage says. On returning from his alms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from desire, and he purifies his mind from desire. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, that he purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning tiredness and lethargy, he abides with a mind free of tiredness and lethargy, seeing, conscious of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from tiredness and lethargy. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated. With a mind inwardly peaceful, he purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. So this is then, this is where we apply Satipatthana and mindfulness of breathing to sort all of those problems out. So just very briefly, at the top there, it starts off with on returning from your alms round, yeah, after you have eaten, then you sit down, you fold your legs crosswise, and sometimes people say you have to sit cross-legged to meditate, otherwise you can't do it. It says so in the sutta, it's right there, folds his legs crosswise. But again, it's important not to take these things in too inflexible a way, because I think the point here is that this was considered the standard way of sitting down in those days. There were chairs, of course, they had benches and these kind of things, but it was very common to sit on the ground. So people were comfortable like that. Very often you will see the monk sitting, the nun sitting at the root of a tree. And if you sit at the root of a tree, then very often one of the things that you, obviously, first of all, you sit on the ground, but also as you get close to the root of the tree, you will sit a little bit higher, just as if you sit on a cushion in a sense, because the roots are kind of going up, right? So you sit fairly comfortably when you sit at the root of a tree. And also, sometimes you can lean back, yeah? You can lean back because you're sitting close to the trunk of the tree and these kind of things. So this is the way that things were done in those days. When you had grown up from being a child, all the way through your childhood, always sitting with your legs crossed. So it was comfortable. You were at ease that way. It was natural. But if you grow up sitting on a chair, then of course it's a very different situation. And you can go through a lot of agony if you try too hard to sit cross-legged too much. Some of you are very impressed. You're sitting cross-legged all the way through the retreat, which is great. And if you're comfortable like that, it's wonderful. But if you're not, sitting on a chair is perfectly fine. People get good meditation that way. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And then we have this idea of setting your body erect, especially when you are ready, mindfulness is established. You can feel that sitting straight actually is comfortable and natural when that happens. And then you establish mindfulness before you. Yeah, and of course, this is the point, again, that I've been trying to stress all the time, is this idea that before you can even do your meditation practice, you have to establish mindfulness first of all. And that then, of course, again, is done through the sila, through how we use our mind in the right way, and also done just by relaxing, just by waiting, just by turning the present moment into the pleasant moment, and just enjoying what you're having now. Mindfulness then tends to arise by itself. If you are ready, if you're not ready, then you can sit there and wait for mindfulness. It may never really arise strongly enough, but at the very least, you can enjoy whatever meditation is there, and then continue to work on the basic factors, and then maybe a few years down the track or a few months down the track, things will change and you will be able to do these things better than before. And then, based on that, you then start watching the breath, etc. And as you do that, these hindrances are then abandoned through that very practice of watching the breath or doing the metta meditation or whatever it is that you do. And of these five precepts, the first two ones are by far the most important ones. The first two is really where all the kind of the most of the work is. Abandoning the desire for the sensual world and abandoning the ill will. And a lot of the last three hindrances, they are a result of the first two ones. So when you eliminate sense desire and ill will, basically the remaining ones tend to fade away at the same time because they are really a consequence of the first two ones. And that's why that is where you put in most of the attention, right? All this retreat, we've been talking about those two first ones, really. And this is true also here. And of those first two ones, the most important one is sensual desire, because it is the most root problem, the root problem that really drives everything else. And all the other ones really often happen as a function of that. So ultimately, we have to deal with that sense desire. And we've been talking a little bit about that on this retreat. That is what happens then as you simply go through, you watch the breath. That is actually one of the ways of overcoming these desires. Why? Because you are finding contentment in the present moment. And by doing that, you're stopping the mind from kind of going into the future, seeing the beauty of all the sensual objects of the world. And then the mind calms down as a consequence. So this just happens then. So focus on the first two ones. The last three ones, don't worry too much about that. They will tend to disappear and tend to get abandoned as you focus on the first two ones. The last one is a little bit interesting. The last one is about doubt, vichikicca. What exactly does doubt mean in this context? And what it means is one's ability to understand what is wholesome and unwholesome on the Buddhist path. That is why only the stream entry abandons doubt, because only when you come to that point and you have seen the mind fully and you have seen how all of these things fit together, you understand the path, only then do you have a full understanding of the wholesomeness in terms of mental qualities and unwholesomeness of mental qualities. It takes a lot of insight even to see this, and this is so this is part of the problem here. And this is why we investigate a lot. We try to understand the mind in all these fine details. What is wholesome? What is unwholesome? And then you uncover gradually all of these very refined corruptions of the mind that stop you from going all the way to samadhi. So that is the Satipatthana practice, the mindfulness of breathing, and all the abandoning of the hindrances that come from that. In previous years, I have been looking in detail at the Anapanasati and these things, and also Satipatthana, but not this time around. So you have to kind of do things a little bit different every year, because it's interesting to do things slightly differently. But now, once that has happened, once you have reached this stage, now you are really ready for all the results, all the fruits that come in this very life from abandoning those five hindrances and from practicing all the path up to this point. Now you're ready for kind of taking that on board and enjoying that. So this is where things start to become very, very ultra supremely present at this particular point. So this is what happens. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, the imperfections, these are the upakilesas of the mind that weaken wisdom, then quite secluded from the sense objects, secluded from the unwholesome qualities, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained, or by mental application, applied mental application and sustained application, something like that, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. So this is the standard description of the first jhana as we find it in the suttas. So once everything, the mind is perfectly clear, mindfulness is perfectly established, everything, every last defilement has been checked out, then you are ready for this. So having abandoned these five hindrances, the imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, right? This is one of those little phrases that is so interesting here. Because as long as these imperfections are there, wisdom has weakness to it. And this is why we try to get to this stage on the path where you enter the really profound samadhi, so that those weaknesses can be fully abandoned. This is why these jhanas are so important on the path. They are important because then you know that you have abandoned all the weaknesses for insight, so it makes the mind ready for insight. And also, it is important because when you enter the jhana, you're actually, the abandonment is complete, and it lasts over a certain amount of time. The defilements have been eliminated with a certain amount of force, if you like, so that it's actually hard for them to re-arise again. And this is the idea of these states. They empower the mind in this way, and the defilements are far away, and they don't come back again. And that enables the mind then to investigate things and to see things without these things re-emerging too easily. That is an important part of why the samadhi is so important. So you abandon it, and it has quite secluded from sensual pleasures. This actually means quite secluded from the senses, the five senses. Kamehi is the plural use of that word. It refers to the five senses. Secluded from unwholesome qualities. Again, this is just the five hindrances. And then you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by vitakka vichara, here translated as applied and sustained thought, which is probably a bit misleading, because what it refers to is the last remnant in the mind, the very last remnant before vitakka vichara cease completely in the second jhana. So because it is the last remnant, it is the most refined thinking, if you like, that is possible to envisage in a human being. And that very refined thinking, that very refined thing, is just this tiny, tiny movement of the mind that remains at this particular point. It's not coarse thinking, it's not the kind of verbalization that we normally have, but it's a slight movement of the mind. And then in the second jhana, when those are abandoned, that is when you enter the final, the full samadhi. Full samadhi, because samadhi means unification of mind, it means immobility of the mind. When you get into the second jhana, your mind is frozen, bang, onto the object. There's no movement anymore. And that is how you understand vitakka vichara in the first jhana. It is still a little bit of movement there. And then real samadhi is when you're absolutely unified with the object, and there is no movement whatsoever anymore. And this is where things are, you know, so different from our ordinary experience of the world. And this is where you have, they talk about in certain meditation traditions, they talk about non-duality. Like you have this Advaita Vedanta tradition, for example. And this is what they, in those traditions, as far as I can see, they must be referring to. Because these are states of non-duality. And this is what makes them so different. Usually, when we look at the world, there's a sense of duality. I am here, the objects are over there. There's a sense of separation between you and the things that you are aware of. But there comes a point on the Buddhist path when that separation disappears completely. Right? It's like you merge with the object. There's only one thing, and that one thing is the blissful experience of the present moment. And you cannot separate the person who experiences that from the actual bliss. It becomes one unified experience. And that is the idea of non-duality. And you can see why when you get to something like that, it is just so different from how we ordinarily experience the world. And because it is so different, because it is so unified, non-duality, it feels like you have kind of merged with the absolute, merged with kind of the essence of the universe, with God or Brahma or the ground of all consciousness or whatever you want to call it. There's all these words for this. and there's no movement, so the will is gone. What you take, the largest part of what you take to be yourself is gone as well. So it feels like a non-self experience. It is entirely blissful. You know, you can see how easy it is to misinterpret these things and think that you have reached kind of the essence of the universe, the essence of what everything is about. But the thing is, from a Buddhist point of view, you haven't. Because, of course, the Buddhist idea then is to actually investigate that. What is this state? And this is what the Buddha does later on. He investigates even these things to see that they too are impermanent. They too have been constructed through your meditation practice and practicing the path. You have given rise to them, and because they are constructed, because they are produced through your practice, they are also inherently dissolvable again later on. They're not things that are permanent and always there. So this is the kind of the genius of the Buddha. He never really gives up on the investigation. He takes it to the very end until there's nothing left. And everything is kind of, and you, there is where you attain the kind of the highest on the Buddhist path. So that is the first jhana. That is the idea of the applied and sustained attention in this case. And the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Seclusion from the senses, seclusion from the five hindrances. And there is a certain rapture and pleasure, piti sukha, that arises based on that. This is specifically called the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And this is a very high, a very delightful, very, very delightful piti sukha. We have, as you may remember, if you think back, we started off, we're looking at the path fairly early on, and we're talking about the idea of non-regret. From non-regret comes pamuja, which is already a joy, degree of joy. From that comes the piti, which is rapture, even more joy. Then comes the tranquility. Then comes the sukha, right? So piti sukha, we have already seen these words before, and they already start long time before you get into the deep samadhis. Right? So already we have been going through all these happinesses, and now we enter a new level of happiness. And this is called the happiness based on seclusion, which is another kind of notch up the scale. So this path is just, it's amazing. You think that you have already, you're enjoying a meditation so much because you have experienced so much happiness on this path, and then there's just more waiting for you around the corner, and just more, and it keeps on going like that. Yeah? And this is kind of one of those remarkable things about this path. You wonder where this is all going to end when you experience all of these happinesses. And what Ajahn Brahm said, he said many years ago, sometimes you wonder if you can take all the happiness. It's just too much. Yeah, isn't that kind of, it's just mind-blowing. And I'm sure, no doubt, that Ajahn Brahm knows exactly what he's talking about when he says those kind of things, because he has been through all of this, and he knows exactly what these things mean. So that is the first jhana. This is only the first jhana, right? This is only the beginning of this. And then the Buddha says to this Brahmin, this Brahmin is called a footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But the noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. And this is one of those very, very interesting statements in the suttas. And there are large... Everything is interesting, of course, but this is interesting because it is different from how you ordinarily often hear about things. And this is that the jhanas, states, are footprints of the Buddha. Right? When you come to the jhanas, you know that you are in the kind of just walking behind the Buddha. The Buddha has been here. The Buddha has left a footprint. The Buddha must also have practiced these things, because this is the only way, really, to gain awakening. Yeah? That's why he passed through these things. So the Buddha has been here. That is what you know when you come to the jhanas. So what that means, of course, is that these things are integral to the Buddhist path. These are integral to awakening. Not only are they integral to that, but you know that you are almost in the presence of awakening itself when you come to the jhana states. Elsewhere, it talks about the jhanas being the sambodhasukha. Sambodhasukha means the happiness of awakening here. You're already reaching stages that are almost equivalent to the awakening experience itself. So this says something about the jhanas. Often people say, oh, I haven't got to the jhanas yet, you know, when will I get there? No wonder you haven't got to the jhanas, that you're almost at the goal when you get to the jhanas. These are incredibly profound states. And sometimes people say, oh, yeah, I got the jhanas, it wasn't that interesting. Sure, you got to the jhanas. When you get to the jhanas, it's a mind-blowing experience. It's what Ajahn Brahm very nicely calls a positive trauma. You are traumatized. Yeah. You can't get it out of your mind. It's like, whoa, this is just absolutely, it's a different, you know, a completely different world that you enter when you get to these things. These are very profound things, and it's important to remember that, because very often people think they don't actually have an appreciation of how profound these things are. And there is so much happiness, so much contentment to be had on the Buddhist path, long before you even get to the jhanas. So enjoy all that happiness, enjoy all that joy, and then gradually you will move towards these extraordinary states that the jhanas actually are. So remember that, footprint of the Tathagata, right? You are almost there, almost seeing the Buddha when you get to these particular states. But, it says here, you don't yet come to the conclusion that this is the Buddha, because you haven't actually reached the final awakening yet. You are in the presence. You are tantalizingly close. You can see the markings, the scrapings, the footmarks, but you haven't actually seen the full result yet. And then we have the other jhanas. I'll go through this fairly briefly. Again, with the stilling of application of the mind and the application of the mind, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without application of the mind, with rapture and pleasure born of samadhi. This too is called a footprint of the Tathagata, etc. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully awakened, etc. So here we have the second jhanas, right? So just briefly, the point here is that the mind for the first time is absolutely unified. That is why it is called singleness of mind. And self-confidence just means that you are fully immersed in the object. You're not holding back at all. This full immersion, that is really the idea of self-confidence here. It's a bit different from what we ordinarily mean by self-confidence, but that is kind of the idea behind this. Again, this is a new type of rapture and pleasure, a new sort of pitisukha. This is the pitisukha that comes when samadhi is perfected for the first time in your life. From this point on, samadhi is perfected because you are fully unified. There's no more sense of duality, no more movement of the mind whatsoever. Second jhana, even more amazing than the first jhana. You kind of think that you come to the first jhana, you think that this must surely be it, there can't be anything beyond this. And then you come to the second jhana and you think, whoa, this is just... You don't know what to say anymore at that point. Okay, so then we get to the third jhana. Again, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, which is, okay, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. This too is called the footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully awakened. So here you are abandoning some of that pleasure, the rapture fades away, and then you enter the pure sukha, the pure happiness. And that's why equanimity and here is also mentioned, because equanimity is then becoming particularly powerful at this point. It says here, feeling pleasure with the body, and that is a bad translation. It doesn't mean that at all. What it means is that you feel pleasure directly. You feel direct pleasure. It is direct because the piti, the rapture has been abandoned. So you feel pure pleasure without that piti being in the way. And that's what it actually means. Kayena sukkang patisang videti is the Pali. And kayena has this, doesn't mean body as it often does. It means a direct, immediate experience of pleasure without any intermediary rapture and that kind of thing. So even more happiness, right? And then you have, on account of which the noble ones declare, he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. So again, you have this understatement, right? He has a pleasant abiding. It sounds, yeah, okay, this is pleasant. But this is like the highest happiness that is possible to experience in samsara. That's what it means, a pleasant abiding here. So, the pinnacle of sukha. No sukha beyond this. So this is the pinnacle of sukha. So remember that when you read the suttas, the Buddha is always understated. So when the Buddha says, now you have reached a happy abiding, it means the most happy abiding at all possible. That's what it actually means. So understatement is kind of a very important part of this. So that is the third jhana. And these things, of course, are extraordinarily pleasant and happy. And it really is impossible, I think, to even have any clue about what these things mean until you start to get fairly close and you actually enter these things. That is when you start to have some idea what's going on. It is just really, really profound stuff. But it's nice to know about these things because it's nice to have some idea what is available on this path and where this path goes. Then we go to the fourth jhana. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. So this is the fourth jhana, and what is the most kind of astonishing thing about this? As we go through each of these jhanas, we're reaching higher stages of pleasure with each one. Every state is more happiness in one way or another. And now, as we enter the fourth jhana, we are giving up all experience of happiness. And that giving up of all experience of happiness, we go to the neutral, neither happiness nor pain. That lack of happiness is actually more pleasant than the happiness. So when you give up happiness, you feel a higher degree of pleasure, a higher degree of contentment, a higher degree of positive experience than when there is happiness there. And this is one of those really almost impossible things to understand. How can neutral feeling be more happy than happy feeling? Well, how is this possible? And really, I think the only way to understand these things is to go there and get to that particular point. You have to go by faith and confidence in the Buddha and those people who have attained these things to some extent to even understand how this is possible. And this is now you can start to understand why the ending of things, every time something ends, there is a greater degree of pleasure there. All the way till you go up, all the way to the end of the path where everything ceases. And then you realize, actually, the ending of everything, for some weird, paradoxical reason, that is the highest kind of happiness that is possible to have. This is the Buddha's teaching. This is why it is so mind-blowing and so hard to understand. It is kind of literally mind-blowing. That's what is so cool about Buddhism. It actually is mind-blowing. The mind, boom, gone, right? And this is why it is so exceptional and so difficult to understand. And of course, the reason why it is so difficult to understand is precisely because of our sense of self. The sense of self, it what hinders us and blinds us to these very profound aspects of the Buddhist path. So those are the four jhanas. And that, of course, is samadhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. When I was talking about the abandoning of the five hindrances before, that was the samma sati, the satipatthanas. From satipatthana, purifying the mind completely, you enter samma samadhi, which is the four jhanas. And now, what we're going to see next, this is the result of that Samma Samadhi. Because then, once you come out of the jhanas, this is what happens. And it happens more or less automatically, because your mind has already been, you've already been brainwashed by the teachings, right? So your mind is kind of ready for this. And now you turn your mind to these truths that you have heard about in the suttas, and you find out whether these things actually are real or not. So this is what happens next. When his mind is thus purified, concentrated, stilled, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge and recollection of past lives. Yeah, so this is what happens next. So when the mind has all these qualities, and these are the qualities that you build up through the samadhi experience, the deeper the samadhi, the more you have of these qualities. And what is important here, of course, are things like the fact that the mind is malleable, wieldy, yeah? So it is very, very, you can work with the mind. The mind doesn't stop. The mind doesn't have the kind of inertia and slowness and doesn't want to do A, doesn't want to do B. It does exactly what you want it to do. Wherever you turn the mind happily follows along, because the mind is very malleable and workable at this point. And of course, important as well is the fact that it is at steady and attained to imperturbability. Now you're going to look at the, try to see the truth of the mind, the truth of what it is to be a being in this world. And to be able to see that, the mind has to be very strong and very imperturbable. If you see something which is difficult to see, and of course seeing things like suffering and seeing non-self, these are can be very hard to see, because you're seeing things that you don't really want to see. You are attached to your sense of self, obviously you are, because it's your identity. To see everything, to see suffering its full scope, you can imagine that that's very, can be very unpleasant as well. Although it leads to happiness, it may be temporarily seem unpleasant. So be able to do that, you have to have an incredibly powerful mind that is imperturbable, unshakable. Nothing in the world can shake it one way or another. You are strong enough to be able to take these things. And that is the idea here behind the word imperturbability. Anenja is the Pali word behind that. And then, because the mind is so strong, and that imperturbability is only found fully when you reach the fourth jhana, not the previous jhanas. And that is why the fourth jhana is especially powerful for making these kind of insights. So you direct your mind to the recollection of past lives. This is where the real recollection of past lives happen here. So you recollect your many past lives. That is one birth, two births, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. So there you are, 100,000 rebirths, right? And then you go into the eons. So I guess it happens fairly quickly, otherwise you'd be there a long time. You can't spend too much, like 1 second in each birth perhaps, something like that, and then you kind of move on. So the mind is obviously incredibly sharp, incredibly fast at this point. You're able to do so much in such a short period of time. There I was, so named, of such a clan, of such an appearance, such was my food or nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere. And there too, I had a name, and my clan was such, and my appearance and nutriment and experience of pleasure and pain was such, and such was my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. Yeah, so you remember your past life, you see the connection between lives, and you see how it all ends up in your present existence, right here and right now. You see how it is all connected together. So, and these, of course, these memories you have here are very powerful memories. So they're very clear, and you can see how it is you kind of moving along from one life to the next one through all of these existences. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. This too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. Yeah, so this is the real method of recalling your past lives. Sometimes people do past life regressions. Sometimes you do your meditation, you have little flashbacks, you think that, oh, maybe I've seen a past life. One of the persons on this retreat came to me and said, oh, I had this experience, and I was wondering whether this might have been a past life or not. But it's very uncertain until you come to this point where the mind is so powerful, so malleable, and you can see the causal connection moving from one life to the next one, how it kind of moves along. And that is how you can know that this is a true memory, because it actually hangs together and it's a very powerful insight. It is not just a flash, kind of, you know, like somebody showing a picture of the past. It is actually all connected together. And this is probably how we know also that our memories in the present life are true, because they fit into an overall narrative, the narrative being your life in this life. Yeah, if it fits into an overall narrative, it's probably a true memory. And sometimes memories can be false. I guess one way of figuring out the false ones is because they don't quite maybe fit in to the overall, your overall experience. So that is the first insight, yeah, and this, remember, this is elsewhere in the suttas, it's called the dispelling of darkness, the turning on of the light. Now you see, before you've been wandering around in darkness, fumbling around, not really knowing what you're doing. Now the light gets turned on, you see things according to reality. Wow, this is what it's like. You are like the little chick hacking out of your eggshell. And for the first time, you're coming out of your eggshell in this life. And you're looking outside and you think, whoa, this is what it's like. Wow, so different. And so much vaster. So, you know, and of course that then informs you about what is real happiness and real suffering in this samsaric existence. Because you have some real data that you can work with at this particular point. Okay. Second one of these three higher knowledges. When his concentrated or stilled mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge and the passing away and reappearance of beings with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human. He sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their karma, according to their actions, thus. These worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech and mind, revilers of the noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech and mind, not revilers of the noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in a heavenly world. Thus, with a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings pass on in according to their actions. This too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata, but a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully awakened. So this is seeing the law of karma, essentially. You see that beings pass on according to their actions. And here you also get a summary of what are the most powerful things that drive the rebirth process. Yeah, bad conduct by body, speech and mind, the revilers or abusers of the noble ones. So you're kind of the person who says bad things about the Buddha, perhaps, or by other people who you think might be, have awakening experience and that kind of thing. And you have wrong view, and you act according to those wrong views as well. These are the sort of main points that end up leading to a bad rebirth in the future. So if you don't do that, then you are fairly safe. You're kind of moving in the right direction for this life. But in the long term, of course, it is much more uncertain how to do that. And remember, as I was saying before, that sometimes people get this wrong idea that this means that we can take charge of our life. That the idea of the law of karma is that you are in charge. All you have to do is to do the right things and the good things. And as a consequence of that, you can ensure that you will be happy in the future. But it doesn't really work like that. It doesn't work like that because whether we do good or bad is not really under our control. Because whether we do good or bad is itself conditioned. And it depends on being conditioned by the right teachings, by the right people, being reborn in the right place. And there's so many factors that will take us away from this. So we are actually not really in charge at all. And that is why you have the simile of the stick in the suttas. Rebirth is a bit like throwing up the stick. And now we get reborn on, it falls down on one end now, on the other end now. So now we get reborn in a bad destination, now in a good one. Because in the long run, if you discount the fact that occasionally you are on the, in the long run, you get reborn in sometimes in good destinations, sometimes in bad ones, all according to causes and conditions, really. That is what is happening there. The feeling that you are in charge is really a delusion in the long run of these things. So that is very briefly for you, the law of karma and how that is seen by the divine eye. The divine eye here is like the mind, the mental eye, right? Not the physical eye, but the mental eye, which can see these things. Then we come to the last of the Tevijas. When his concentrated mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfections, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge and the destruction of the asavas. Asavas here called the taints, corruptions might be a better translation. And when you do that, you understand as it actually is, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the end of suffering. This is the way leading to the end of suffering. These are the asavas. This is the origin of these asavas. This is the end of the asavas or the corruption. This is the way leading to the end of these asavas. So what you are understanding here is the Four Noble Truths. Yes? This is a full insight into the nature of existence. And part of this is also the insight into non-self, because that is part of the understanding of suffering. Also the insight into impermanence, which also is part of that. It also includes the insight into dependent origination, because that is part of the origin and cessation of suffering. So everything is part of this. It happens in a moment, bang, you have that insight. But all of these things are actually included within that. And then you kind of have to unpack it and see what it is afterwards. And I think this is one reason why the Buddha spent quite a lot of time in seclusion, just reflecting on what he had discovered, and then being able to kind of verbalize it to all his disciples later on. So, this too, Brahmin, is called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple has not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Rather, he is in the process of coming to that conclusion. So we seem to be talking about here is the first one is just the stream entry. And then we come to the final liberation at the very end here. So then when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from all these corruptions of sensual desire, corruption of desire for existence, and also the corruption of delusion itself. And when it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands birth has come to an end. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of existence. And then that is when finally you come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is fully enlightened, awakened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. And it is at this point, Brahmin, that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in detail. You have seen the elephant, you have seen the Buddha, and you now know what this is all about, and you have no doubt anymore. You have seen the end of all suffering. The birth has come to an end. This is the final understanding when you become an Arahant, that birth has come to an end. There's no more of this. And now you have attained the highest happiness. And then you have this wonderful little conclusion at the very end, the standard conclusion at the end of the suttas, when somebody is really inspired. And this is what they say. When this was said, the Brahmin Janusoni said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gautama, magnificent Master Gautama. Master Gautama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what has been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark to those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gautama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of bhikkhus, and sometimes bhikkhunis as well. From today, let Master Gautama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life." There you are. That is how this wonderful teaching on the elephant's footprint comes to an end. And now you know everything that is waiting for you down the track, right? Isn't that wonderful? There's so much inspiring things. There's so many remarkable things. Some of those things you may wonder whether they really exist or not, and that's fine. You just kind of keep on practicing, and as you do that, this kind of unfolds in front of you. And as you do it, as it unfolds in front of you, your faith and confidence and everything, it increases stage by stage, and then one day, bang, you see all these kind of things. So there you are. So that is. That is pretty much, that's it, really. is there any last comments or questions, anything that needs to be clarified so that you don't go back home and you get completely confused and you say Buddhism isn't for me, I'm gonna become a Muslim or I'm gonna become a Christian or whatever. That would be terrible, wouldn't it, if that happened after retreat and everyone walks off and they have given up on Buddhism. Oh. So, okay. Everybody good? Great. So I just wish you all the best. It's been a very, as far as I'm concerned, a very nice retreat. Thank you everyone for helping out. Thank you especially for Bianca, who is not here. She's not usually here at this time. And of course, Burr and every one of you for helping out. And also thank you, I can thank myself as well, I suppose, for being here. and Venerable Kalika and the nuns and everyone. It's been a good thing. So I wish you all the very best in your practice. Keep on doing this. And then every year when you come back, remember what this is about. It's about a gradual movement in terms of more wholesome qualities, more good qualities, and a reduction in the bad ones. And as long as that is happening, there is no choice. One day you will have to reach the goal of this amazing spiritual life. And what a wonderful thing that is. So that's it for now. So let's just pay the final respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we leave. Okay, very good.